So welcome everyone. Thank you for being here. My name is Roland Raja and I'm the Director of the International Economy Program here at the Lowy Institute. Tonight it's my pleasure to be hosting this evening's event with Professor Maurice Obstfeld, who will be talking about the future of the global economy, managing the next economic crisis, and some of the latest thinking in macroeconomics. And certainly there's plenty to talk about, from trade wars and rising populism to faltering multilateralism and a whole host of structural changes ongoing in the global economy. Professor Obstfeld is one of the world's leading minds on this topic. He's a leading figure in the field of international economics and macroeconomics. His most recent work focuses on the global context of US monetary policy, the architecture of the euro area, macroeconomic policy in China, and frictions in international financial markets. Most recently, he served as the chief economist of the International Monetary Fund from late 2015 to the end of 2018. And before that, he was a member of President Obama's Council of Economic Advisors. Currently, he is the class of 1958 Professor of Economics at the University of California, Berkeley, where he has taught since 1991. So how tonight will proceed is that Professor Obstfeld will first deliver a short address, and then after that, he and I will sit down for a bit of a conversation and a few additional questions before we'll open it up to the floor for questions and answers with the audience. So with that, can you please join me in welcoming Professor Obstfeld to the lectern?
It's a great pleasure to be here in Sydney. It's my first visit here, and especially to be at the Lowy Institute. If you come to a talk on economics, you should expect to get some numbers. So I'm going to start out with some numbers. Shouldn't be too hard to remember all of them. And I think they put where the global economy is and has come from in some context. So the IMF shares with the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, a particular way of measuring global economic growth. And the World Bank does it differently, which is a source of endless confusion. But based on the IMF and the OECD methodology, global economic growth over the period from 1992 to 2007 averaged 3.8% per year. So remember that number, 3.8%. Over the period since the financial crisis, essentially the last decade from 08 to 2018, it averaged 3.4%, which is lower. The IMF is predicting 3.3% for 2019, and the OECD recently, just yesterday, came out with a fairly scary assessment of the global economy, and they're talking about 3.2% for 2019. So remember those numbers. The 3.8 to 3.4 drop between 97-07 and 08-18 seems like it's not such a big deal. But if you sort of break up the world into advanced economies and emerging economies, I think it helps us understand some of the malaise we're seeing in some of the advanced economies. For emerging economies, on average, they grew at 5.0% per year between 97 and 2007. So that's, of course, higher than the world number. And the world number is higher than the rate of growth for advanced economies, which was 2.8%. This is to be expected. You know, emerging markets are converging to higher income levels, they're importing technology, they're investing more. So 5% over that period, sorry, I said 97 to 07, but I meant 92 to 07. I didn't really write it clearly enough. So 5%. And then if we go to the decade roughly from 08 to 18, they grew at 5.1%. So it's basically the same. Now remember, the advanced economies grew at 2.8% between 92 and 07. Between 08 and 18, they grew at 1.4%. exactly half the average growth rate. So if you look at the world, you know, there's somewhat of a decline in growth, but a super sharp decline for advanced economies and level for emerging markets. So it's no surprise that voters in many advanced economies are restless. The performance of the past is nowhere near being reached in terms of income growth. Now, part of the relatively favorable performance up until the financial crisis was the 2000s, and that was an interesting period. We had the emergence of China as a major power in the global economy, a major exporter. We had the euro area being created, and then both the U.S. and the euro area, and in fact, most of the world, experiencing a boom in global liquidity in many, many countries, housing market appreciation, which ultimately planted the seeds for the global financial crisis. And as our numbers show, you know, in the advanced economies, there has been recovery, but to nowhere near the numbers of the past. The policy response to the crisis was a vigorous one, and it helped avoid a much deeper downturn for the global economy. In many countries, fiscal policy was deployed. Central banks first lowered interest rates sharply, in some cases to zero. Then a number of them engaged in unconventional policies of various kinds, quantitative easing, even negative interest rates, even targeted lending operations. China was notable because China rolled out a massive stimulus. And in fact, that stimulus has led to various overhangs for the global economy, which have to some degree haunted them and haunted other countries since the crisis period. In particular, China's, and I think Australia is really one of the countries that experienced this to some degree and suffered from it. China, as you know, is one of the most raw materials intensive economies in the world. You know, they consume 50% or more of the world's base metals. And so the massive stimulus in China amounted to a demand impulse that led to a massive commodity boom in commodity exporters. And as China reined back that stimulus after the worst of the global financial crisis, commodity exporters saw big effects in their terms of trade. In a number of countries, there had been excessive investment in the mining sector, and this led to some overhang. But in the midst of the crisis, what China was doing was very welcome to its global partners. Another aspect of the crisis that was important was multilateralism. The G20 was created. They agreed on policies to stimulate their economies jointly, and this was very powerful, both through its effects on aggregate demand and in bolstering the confidence of markets that policymakers were acting decisively to deal with the unprecedented turmoil. Many asked, after the crisis broke out, why did economists not see it coming? What was wrong with their models? And we could spend a lot of time on that. You know, for me, the crisis and its aftermath illustrated two important points that I think were underappreciated, but that bear keeping in mind as we move into the future. One of these was the importance of finance. Many mainstream macro models pushed financial imperfections and frictions to the background, thinking they were not terribly important compared to the starring role of monetary policy. You know, if you think about this seriously, you realize that there's a certain sort of intellectual dishonesty in focusing on monetary or fiscal policy only and leaving aside financial market imperfections, because, you know, one of the reasons money is useful is that, you know, credit is always imperfect. You know, if you always knew who you were lending to and knew with certainty that they would repay you, spot transactions in cash would not really be necessary. So at its heart, the idea of having money is somehow related to finance and financial markets. And you miss something important when you push them in the background. So economists have started thinking much more seriously about how finance and macro fit together. I don't think they are there yet in terms of a grand synthesis, but progress has been made. The other area where I think we learned a lot is in the realm of expectations and how very, very important those are in driving markets. And one aspect of this is to question the rationality of markets, the absence of what Keynes called animal spirits driving asset prices and spending. But the other aspect of this, even if people are fully rational, is that our models underestimated the ability of market panics to basically create facts which validated the panics ex post. The classic example of this is the bank run. You know, if everyone thinks that a bank cannot make good on its deposits and withdraw their funds, then the bank, in fact, will not be able to make good on all of the deposits. And so if everyone else is running the bank, it's rational for you to run the bank also. We have deposit insurance to sort of deal with this in most countries, not all countries. But it's a classic issue. But what we saw in the crisis is that many, many other markets are subject to this sort of panic in which credit dries up or in which asset prices fall precipitously because people expect them to fall. In the European context, the sovereign debt crisis that occurred in the early 2000s after the global financial crisis illustrated how when even an advanced country cannot print its own currency, then market expectations that it could default on its sovereign debt can drive up its borrowing costs and make default a real possibility. So, you know, the crisis in Greece, difficulties in Portugal, Spain, Ireland, Italy, all illustrated this very frightening possibility. And part of the task of reforming the Eurozone is to make this less possible. So, you know, to sort of summarize, we had a big crisis. The world in terms of growth looks different afterward, particularly as far as the advanced economies are concerned. We probably know less about macroeconomics and finance than we thought we did, and we're working on it. And the big question at the moment, following a slowdown in global growth, which set in at the end of last year and seems to be continuing, is when is the next global recession? And if one asks that question, one also has to ask, what will policymakers do about it? I don't personally see a recession happening, certainly not this year. I'm sort of being fast and loose with the word recession, though. You could ask, how do you define a global recession? I'm not gonna go there, but think of a sharp slowdown that is occurring in many countries. I don't see a severe slowdown happening this year, but one has to admit that there are triggers out there which could lead to further slowdowns in growth. If you read the OECD report from yesterday, they're quite alarmed about this. I don't think I'm quite as alarmed as they are because, you know, there are some sources of strength underlying growth right now in most advanced economies. These are really related to the fact that people have jobs, that service sectors are strong, that even in some countries, real wages are rising a little bit. So consumption is holding up. But there are triggers. Trade tensions are a big trigger. And a lot of the recent slowing we've seen in the world economy is specifically in sectors that are open to trade. You know, manufacturing has been weaker. The volume of real trade has grown very slowly in recent months. I worry about politics spooking the markets, populism giving rise to bad policies. The sort of poster child for this is Brexit, which has caused a slowdown in the UK economy. And if it leads to a so-called hard Brexit, that I think would be very tough. The world is much more indebted than it was before the crisis. And should there be a tightening of financial conditions, that could bring its own problems. And finally, geopolitics is looking very, very dicey in several recent regions. What will policymakers do if there is a crisis? Well, the good news is that in many countries, banks are safer than they were before. They have more capital. The Basel III rules that were agreed after the crisis have helped. But these rules don't extend. And the capital levels don't extend to non-bank actors, which are very, very important. Fiscal space is lower in many countries. Australia is in a fairly favorable position with respect to its debt and its deficit. And in a crisis, its government could act to support the economy with fiscal policy. But if you are Italy, for example, things look a lot more difficult. Interest rates, even a decade after the crisis, remain at almost unprecedentedly low levels in nominal terms, and so there's simply less room to lower them. The ECB remains at a negative interest rate. There are other tools that could be used by monetary policy, but the strength of those tools is open to question. So the very aggressive monetary response we saw in 2008, 2009 is unlikely to be repeated. What about the multilateral response? Well, multilateralism is under attack in many respects these days, certainly in the trade area, in the climate area, in the defense area, if a global crisis were to break out, you know, it's very unclear if the type of response mounted a decade ago could be repeated. And one of the reasons for this is that the nature of U.S. leadership in the global economy, and I have to apologize as an American for using the term U.S. leadership, but I think it's fair to say that in many respects, the U.S. has been a key actor in the construction of the post-war multilateral system. Its willingness to continue functioning within that system is open to question. And that, I think, is something that has to give one pause as one contemplates what the next global recession would look like. Now, here I'm focusing a lot on sort of short-run cyclical risks and responses. But as we look at many, many economies, the crises of the day, which are largely political crises, have sapped the attention of political leaders to a number of long-run issues where policy initiatives are desperately needed. Part of what underlies the advanced economy's very slow growth is very low productivity growth. Labor markets have recovered. Growth has not in many parts of the world. The U.S. is an exception, but the U.S. also mounted an exceptional pro-cyclical fiscal stimulus last year. For productivity to be addressed, there needs to be more thought about how to promote research and development, how to promote our institutions of higher learning, how to promote higher education, secondary education, early life education, how to promote productive infrastructure investment. All of these things are necessary. In some countries, growing inequality has been a problem. I think the United States is notable in this respect. Thinking about the future of labor markets and the future of work in a world where artificial intelligence may make a number of jobs redundant is something that we should be planning for and not just assuming that the market will take care of it. And finally, if I can call it that, the climate crisis is becoming worse. At a recent conference, I was in a conversation with another economist, and he marveled that it didn't take longer for me to get from California to Kazakhstan, which is where we were. And I said, well, we fly over what used to be the North Pole. The effects of warming are accelerating according to all indications. And, if you define climate broadly as the natural environment in which humanity has developed and thrived up until this point, there are other margins along which there is a crisis. There is a biodiversity crisis, for example, which could have untold implications. So, economists are always gloomy. I've lived up to that, I think. But I think we need to demand of our leaders, political leaders, that they do think about these issues, not just think about the short term issues, but also focus on the long term issues. And with that, I'll enter into conversation with Roland.
Thanks for that, Maury. That was very fascinating. And you touched on so many issues, so there's a lot for us all to work with. But I'm going to maybe issue you with a quick challenge then. Can you tell us something that's a positive thing for the outlook that you think we should pay some attention to?
That's always a tough question for me. I used to attend the OECD's Working Party 3 meetings, and Stanley Fischer, who was at that time the vice chairman of the Fed, would always listen to my recitation of downside risks, and he would say, "Well, do you have any upside risks for us?" I came up with a list of upside developments, at least, which I thought would be uplifting for people to hear, and just to imagine what the world would be like if it wasn't the way it is. So, one example of a development is that the U.S. and China settle their trade problem, and the U.S., China, and other allies agree on a constructive way to reform the WTO to make that a sustainable trading relationship. That would be a great thing. I don't really expect that to happen, so that doesn't really answer your question.
Can I give you a topic of suggestion?
Sure, go for it.
Could be good or bad, but you talked about productivity and productivity growth being very weak. A lot of lay people, business people, and so on would say that's preposterous, right? Because of technology. Right, everyone's got an iPhone or a smartphone or something in their pocket. People find that quite counterintuitive. There's a range of explanations for that. Maybe you might have some particular views on that. But one of them is that it's just a lag. and the technological gains to productivity are coming. What do you think about that? Do you think that's coming? And if it is coming, maybe it comes with downsides as well still. But let's focus on the upsides first. Do you think that's a possibility?
Well, you know, I think your question raises two issues for me. One is that, you know, the part of the debate over productivity is whether it is actually mismeasured, because it certainly is mismeasured. You know, we have a number of services that we get over the internet that are free. They're not counted in GDP. You know, the best estimates that people have made are that those, while they explain something, would not explain fully the productivity slowdown. Now, the other part of your question, which is, I think, very interesting, and which, you know, I think gives somewhat of an answer to your first question, is that, you know, science continues to make incredible advances. You know, we discover new things about the universe. We discover new ways of treating diseases. It's really quite amazing. And it's something that, you know, governments have to continue to support. They don't always do. You know, the question is, how does this translate into productivity? Like, what is the process by which it translates into productivity? You know, my guess is it eventually will, but it does take time. The classic example of this is was written about by an economic historian named Paul David, which is electricity. You know, electricity came along in the late 19th century. But for it to fully get incorporated into the sinews of production took decades. And, you know, I think that's just a matter of people sort of figuring out how discoveries fit together. You know, something can be remarkable, but in isolation doesn't really do much for you. But then when you can combine it with other things that use complementary technologies, you can really get huge increases in productivity. You know, we kind of had some sorts of computers, you know, a long time ago. But, and in fact, in the late, mid to late 80s, when we got desktops, that seemed like a great thing. But we didn't see anything in aggregate productivity until about a decade later. And then we had an explosion. It's important to realize, though, that you know, when you have that sort of a big push in technology, it doesn't necessarily get you a permanent increase in the growth rate, because, you know, something happens, it raises your level of output, and while you're moving to that new plateau of output, growth is higher, but then you've sort of done it. You know, you've accomplished it, you've reached the peak, and then you go back where you are. So I think what we're seeing now is that we're sort of in a technological lull, or maybe it's a gestation period. And growth is being driven down by, you know, some fundamental forces, of which one of them is demography, aging, and some things will come along. I mean, there's not going to be any one thing, but there will be a sequence of complementary advances. And, you know, at some point in the future, we'll probably see a surge in productivity that may last a decade. And then, you know, we'll be asking again, why is productivity so low? Productivity growth so low? But we'll all be richer when we're asking it.
Yeah, and of course, I won't raise the fact that those technological changes may in turn induce a whole range of other negative things in terms of being potentially disequalizing and so forth as well.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it could turn out that one of the big... That could be the case. We have to get ready for that possibility and try to anticipate it. But it could be the case also that... you know, there are advances, for example, in green energy that that, you know, come together that end up giving us much cheaper energy, that also lower emissions, and you know, that would be a huge upside.
Mm. Well, that's a second positive thing you've been able to locate on as well. But sticking with the positive, then I just want to draw you again on the US-China trade issues. Of course, you know, the negotiations have broken down and doesn't look particularly optimistic, but it's difficult to understand exactly what a solution might exactly look like. So I want to ask you, like, what do you think a feasible solution would look like? So if the world wanted to say, all right, things are
starting to turn around at some point, maybe not now, maybe in the future. What are the ingredients, you think?
Well, you know, I think the question is, you know, what would be feasible with this particular U.S. administration? There might be a wider range of feasibility with some other administration, and part of the problems with this administration is that there seem to be many elements of the unhappiness with China, some of which are justified and some of which are fairly unjustified. So if you want to focus on the bilateral deficit, if that's what you're worried about, you know, China can handle that really easily. You know, they basically start buying more stuff from the U.S., buy less from elsewhere. It's maybe inefficient for them, but you know, ultimately, it's a win in terms of cost benefit analysis. If the goal is to sort of keep China down and keep them from developing in key industries, then that's a much tougher lift. And so it's not clear to me, you know, where the U.S. is going with this. And certainly there are people in the U.S. administration who believe in the latter, you know, the latter goal. You know, if that's the goal, then there's not going to be a solution set. You know, I believe there is a structural problem with China's position in the global economy, simply in terms of the opacity of what it does and the degree of government involvement in the economy, the many levers it can pull, which raise the suspicion in its trading partners that it's not playing on a level field. You know, if that is the issue, then I think that is solvable, you know, with goodwill from both sides. You know, China would have to become more transparent in a sense, and you know, change some of its practices. But that's doable. Whether that is going to satisfy you know, Mr. Trump you know, advisors, we don't know.
Yeah, no, I think that's very, very much correct. I mean, depending on the objectives, it's hard to say how things can or should go. But transparency certainly seems to be, you know, a key ingredient. A related topic then is also around something like the Belt and Road Initiative from China. Transparency, again, very important in that sense, and in particular because you've just come from your stint as the chief economist of the IMF. IMF being one of those institutions that actually has a fairly, probably one of the better grasps of what's going on in terms of Belt and Road. So there's a lot of debate about this, right? Is it a growth-enhancing initiative that's financing infrastructure investment, or is it basically creating problems on debt sustainability, governance, environmental standards, so on and so forth? Obviously, there's various truths and untruths on this front, but how do you sort of see it? And if you're advising, the Chinese government, what do you think they need to do to actually improve it? Do you have any particular insights on that?
You know, if China were devoting all the resources they are to this initiative purely out of altruism, they would be the first government in the history of the world to do that. So, you know, obviously they have a number of objectives, you know, projecting power, mostly soft power, but maybe not entirely, securing supplies of natural resources, you know, in specific areas, for example, in Central Asia, they have an interest in seeing prosperity there because they don't want that part of the world to become a haven for Muslim terrorism. So they have a big interest in strengthening those governments, and it also provides a buffer with Russia because despite the whatever photo ops, you know, President Xi and President Putin stage, there's a long, you know, historical rivalry, regional rivalry between those countries. Now, having said that, you know, the initiative also, I think, holds out potential benefits for recipient countries. So I mentioned I was just in Kazakhstan. Kazakhstan is a great example. It's absolutely in the center of the Eurasian mass, although it borders on China. It is completely landlocked. It is sparsely populated. It could benefit tremendously. It could benefit tremendously by having better transportation networks that sort of link it to other economies in the region. And the Belt and Road Initiative is a ready source of funding for that kind of project. I think Africa is another area where, internal transportation is terrible. So if they have embarked on a sort of free trade area, but you don't have like a road from Nairobi to Kampala, and it's unclear what it means. Most of those countries trade with the outside world, not with each other. So the Belt and Road Initiative could unlock great things. The problem is that it's often the loans are made in a non-transparent way with non-transparent terms to governments which can be quite corrupt. That leads to inefficiency. It can lead to the wrong projects being chosen. It can lead to debt levels that are ultimately unsustainable. And China is, China tends to, extract pretty strong terms in terms of collateral. Often these loans are collateralized with natural resource flows, which, China needs. So that's very convenient for them. China is not a member of the Paris Club, so it doesn't really subscribe to this debt restructuring thing. And in some cases, the collateral has even been real estate. There was a port in Sri Lanka, which China financed. Sri Lankans couldn't pay the bills. China possessed the port, and that gives it a military presence, on the Indian Ocean, which is very convenient. So, I think the question for BRI is how can you, channel these resources in a way that, allows China to fulfill some realistic goals, because they're not doing this, out of the goodness of their hearts, but also, avoids, avoids abuses and misallocation. More transparency, I think, would reassure other global actors like, the fund, the bank, the EBRD, that, this stuff is being well done. And they could even think about partnering more with such institutions.
I might ask you one last question before we go to the floor. So everyone, please be ready with your own questions. Just to come back to the talk, some of the remarks that you made. So of course, with interest rates low and public debt space also somewhat constrained around the world, there is a downturn or recession for active fiscal policy. There's probably more space on that side of things. But say balancing against that, and or say that is not forthcoming for a variety of reasons, and the options then fall to a variety of unconventional monetary policies, negative interest rates, quantitative easing, so-called helicopter money, right, changing to a nominal GDP target. What are your thoughts then about, how would you rank some of these choices, right? How would you think about them?
I think speaking realistically, we don't have a lot of space to lower interest rates in many economies, and in some economies, balance sheets are already large. QE has probably been pushed to a limit. You could do more forward guidance. You could promise to hold interest rates at zero for the next century, and how credible that would be. At a certain point, forward guidance loses its credibility. I think monetary policy has its limits. I think fiscal policy has more space to run. Now, again, the debt levels that you generate if you're already highly indebted have to be dealt with down the road. But it's probably the case that, you know, if you don't deploy fiscal policy and you let a recession deepen, that you end up in an even worse fiscal position. So the analogy I have in mind is that, you know, antibiotics, if you use them again and again, you know, can breed resistant bacteria, and they lose their effectiveness. And you don't really know at what point that's going to happen. But if you have an infection and there's one antibiotic available, you're not going to say, well, you know, gee, if I take this, there's a chance that it'll become less effective over time. So let me take the risk of dying from this infection, you know, so that I don't, you know. So, you know, in a deep recession, we'll have no choice but to use fiscal policy. And, you know, that will likely mean, unless, you know, we can rely on growth rates remaining above interest rates, which I don't think we can in all circumstances, that we'll have to deal with that down the road with higher tax burdens.
There's a few other further things maybe someone will pick up on in the audience and that, but that was excellent. Maybe we'll go to the floor. So if you have a question, just please put up your hand and just wait for the microphone and just please just state your name and any affiliation. Thanks.
Good evening. I'm David Landers. I'm the chair of Dana Asia. We're a social business investment fund. I just checked the U.S. debt clock and... it's above $22 trillion. But that doesn't even include unfunded liabilities, pension liabilities, military commitments, and so forth. And estimates are that the real debt plus unfunded liabilities of the U.S. Could be 10 times the current debt level. So when you look at that, and you look at U.S. GDP, you say, you know, if you took 10% of U.S. GDP every year, it would take you 60 years to pay all that back. But then debt keeps growing every year. So that's going to keep growing at 6% plus per year. So it's even worse than that. So what I'm getting to with all this is there ever a price to pay? And if there is, what is the price to pay? Or do the MMT theorists have it right?
Yeah, that is a big question. I don't know if you want me to comment separately on MMT, but I do believe there is a price to pay down the road. I think it was unconscionable for the U.S. to engineer a fiscal expansion at the point in the cycle where they were, you know, especially given the unfunded entitlements you mentioned, which they have also, you know, resolutely avoided dealing with whenever the opportunity arose. You know, I think the fiscal history of the, I don't want to really make a political speech, but, you know, in 2000, the U.S. had a balanced budget, and it's been frittered away. And it is always justified by the same argument, which never has worked and never will work, which is that if you cut taxes, they will generate enough growth such that debt does not go up. Now, I think ultimately there is a price to pay, but you know, if you're a politician with a limited term, you assume that someone else is going to pay it, and you know, if you try to do something, you know, you may be punished by the voters. I think the solution is to try to, you know, educate voters, talk to them as if they are grown-ups, and appeal to the fact that, you know, they, in many cases, have children who will have children who will have children who eventually are going to have to deal with this. And, you know, it will not be solved by printing money, although it could be at the cost of an epic inflation. Now that brings me to the MMT. MMT is the, you know, So the right wing has this supply side stuff, and then the left wing has MMT. You know, we can print money, that'll take care of everything. It's no problem. Don't worry, be happy. And you know, it's I don't know what to say. It's just so wrong. you know, this is how Venezuela manages its economy, and you see the results. You know, again, people will say, you know, who don't know much about economic history, that, well, look, there's no inflation. In fact, central banks are struggling to get inflation up. So we can print money. It's not going to be a problem. And so this, you know, this puts in mind that, you know, another medical analogy, you know, which is measles. You know, we haven't had measles. Measles has not been a problem for a long time. And so people have sort of decided, some people, that, you know, there are risks to inoculation and they're just not going to get inoculated. And lo and behold, you know, measles is coming back. So, you know, if we engage in this sort of money financing, inflation will come back. It's the surest way to get inflation to come back. And, you know, inflation at the kind of rates you would need to take care of the U.S. fiscal commitments, including these entitlements, would be massive. So, you know, the benefit of doing some sort of entitlement reform, like now, or you know, really should have been done years ago, is that you know, unlike a very large fiscal correction, you can change sort of small things and they will accumulate over time. So for example, you can change the way you measure the consumer price index that you index benefits to, and that can have a huge effect. And so, you know, you don't suffer all the pain up front. The current voters don't suffer it. Now of course, you know, they can calculate present values, but still it's a much easier way to go. And yet, you know, politicians in the U.S. won't do it. The last time there was a serious review of Social Security was, you know, 35 years ago in the Reagan administration. And that was actually extremely helpful. Bigger still than Social Security is the medical entitlements. And to deal with those, you really need a thoroughgoing reform of the healthcare system to get medical costs down to, you know, what we see in other advanced economies that have equal or better qualities of medical care than the U.S. has.
Thorough answer. Yes, in the front, Ross Gittins.
Ross Gittins of the Sydney Morning Herald. You mentioned that advances in medical science produce benefits that aren't picked up in productivity as we measure it.
No, I said that about. I didn't say that about medical science. I said that about you know, some of our IT technologies, smartphones.
You didn't say. Well, yeah. I'd say I think you could have said it because we live longer lives, we live healthier lives, and GDP only picks up a shadow of that when we buy the pills that deliver that. If you accept that. My question is, doesn't that demonstrate that there's more to life than productivity? And if that's the case, is it possible that we worry more than we need to about the lower productivity that we're getting? And I would add to that, a point you made, and you'll tell me if I've got you wrong, that although we've had lower growth, we've done quite well at creating jobs. Now, economic growth is partly about making us all richer. It's also about making sure we've got enough jobs for people who want to work. If we're not doing so badly on that, why are we so worried about productivity being lower than it used to be?
I think you raised a number of very good points. You know, on the jobs, I would just say that, you know, one debate is about the quality of the jobs and whether people are, you know, as satisfied or finding the kind of satisfied, skill intensive work that they might want to find. I think that's a big issue. You know, GDP is a very strange measure of human welfare, you know, if you really think about it. And it doesn't capture a lot about the quality of life. You know, from a narrow economic perspective, you know, it doesn't capture, for example, you know, negative costs to the environment from production. That stuff is just not priced. You know, we could price it, and that would be an improvement. But GDP doesn't capture it, and so all of that stuff should actually subtract in a sense. You know, I agree on the point that it's very imperfect, and that we may be too obsessed with productivity growth at the expense of other things. In fact, the discourse over the effects of the U.S. corporate tax cut and you know, the sort of insistence that we have to get, you know, 3% productivity growth or 4% productivity growth, or if the or GDP growth, or if the, you know, the Fed were to cut interest rates by 100 basis points, you'd get 5% GDP growth. It's kind of ridiculous. I mean, and it indicates the extent to which this has been sort of fetishized at some level by economists. But you do kind of need something. I think the, you know, one way to go is to, you know, think more about some of the issues that you raised. For example, you know, Chad Jones, an economist at Stanford, has tried to build some of the issues you raised about the quality of health into GDP numbers and modify them in that way. And it turns out that his numbers aren't like all that different from just plain GDP growth, but it does take into account something that's very, very important. And thinking harder about that would be useful. There have been attempts to do this over the decades. Bill Nordhaus, who won the Nobel Prize this year for his work on climate economics, did some work on this decades ago, and I think it would repay some thinking, because basically, you know, what we do when we measure GDP and productivity growth is not that different from, you know, what you know, people like Kuznets and Stone came up with, you know, back in the 30s and 40s, and you know, the world has changed a lot.
I think we got time for one more question. Yeah, at the front.
So one of the potential shocks that could hit the global economy in the short to medium term is a disruptive adjustment in the Chinese exchange rate. So I'd just be interested in your perspective on that, how likely it is, how the Chinese authorities are managing it, and whether there's any global institutions that we should be working on that would help manage the transition to a more flexible Chinese exchange rate.
Yeah. Well, we did see a very disruptive adjustment in the summer of 2015, which I actually view as a mistake on the part of the Chinese authorities. It's sort of a strategic mistake and a conceptual mistake, but it did you know, have a big impact on markets and a big impact on global growth. Well, it clearly had a big impact on markets. It occurred at a time when Chinese growth was slowing for other reasons. So it was part of a constellation of events that did have an impact on global growth. You know, partly as a result of that, the Chinese did tighten their controls on capital outflows. And one other thing that happened around that time was that China entered the special drawing right, which requires them to sort of maintain parity between their onshore exchange rate and the offshore rate. And to do that, they've also intervened a lot in offshore markets. You know, my sense is that absent some sort of massive financial crisis in China, it would be very unlikely that they could be forced into a disruptive, involuntary move in the exchange rate. You know, I think they have it pretty firmly under control at the moment, and I think they have the tools to tighten control even more if they need to. particularly in the environment of trade tension with the U.S., they understand that allowing too much of a depreciation would lead to, you know, all sorts of repercussions in the bilateral relationship, which would be unpleasant, maybe even more unpleasant than, you know, what we're seeing now. And so I don't view that as a big risk at the moment.
Okay. Unfortunately, we've come to the end of our time allotment. So thank you for that, Maury. That was an excellent talk, and you handled a whole range of questions, including from myself. So would everyone just join me in thanking Professor Obstfeld for his discussion.